welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. When recently polled about summer reading habits, a group of Goodreads readers came up with some surprising preferences. Asked what genre folks like to read on vacation, only 10% chose books that steam up your cabana, versus 59% who answered books that transport you to a different world. So, ladies and gents, dust off your literary suitcases and off we go. This week, the Book Report keeps it light, lively, and easy to pack. Speaking of being transported, my guest today, Mandy Smith, shares her entertaining experiences as a Virgin Atlantic flight attendant. You might want to put her new book, Cabin Fever, on your itinerary. So, ready for takeoff? As we turn to page one of the Book Report. In Nina George's The Little Paris Bookshop, we meet Monsieur Perdu, who describes himself as a literary apothecary. From his floating bookstore on a barge on the Seine, he prescribes novels for the hardships of life. Using his intuitive feel for the exact book a reader needs, Perdu mends broken hearts and souls. The only person he can't seem to heal through literature is himself. He's still haunted by heartbreak after his great love disappeared. She left him with only a letter, which he's never opened. When Perdu is finally tempted to read the letter, he hauls anchor and departs on a mission to the south of France, hoping to make peace with his loss and discover the end of the story. Joined by a best-selling but blocked author and a lovelorn Italian chef, Perdu travels along the country's rivers, dispensing both his wisdom and his books. An ensemble cast performs the book.
The two generals of No. 27 Rue Montagnard, Madame Bernard, the owner, and Madame Rosalette, the concierge, had caught Monsieur in a pincer movement between their ground-floor flats.
"That Le Pi has treated his wife shamelessly. Scandalously, like a moth treats a wedding veil. You can hardly blame some people when you look at their wives, fritches in Chanel. But men, monsters, all of them. Ladies, I don't quite know what."
"Not to you, of course, Monsieur Perdu. You are cashmere compared with the normal yarn from which men are spun.
Anyway, we're getting a new tenant. On the fourth floor. Yours, Monsieur."
"But Madame has nothing left. Absolutely nothing. Only shattered illusions. She needs just about everything.
And that's where you come in, Monsieur. Give whatever you can. All donations welcome."
"Of course. Maybe a good book."
"Actually, we were thinking of something more practical. A table, perhaps. You know, Madame has..."
"Nothing. I got that." The bookseller could not imagine what might be more practical than a book, but he promised to give the new tenant a table. He still had one. Monsieur Perdu pushed his tie between the top buttons of his white, vigorously ironed shirt and carefully rolled up his sleeves. Inward, one fold at a time, up to the elbow. He stared at the bookcase in the corridor. Behind the shelves lay a room he hadn't entered for almost 21 years. 21 years and summers and New Year's mornings. But in that room was the table. He exhaled, groped indiscriminately for a book, and pulled Orwell's 1984 out of the bookcase. It didn't fall apart, nor did it bite his hand like an affronted cat. He took out the next novel, then two more. Now he reached into the shelf with both hands, grabbed whole parcels of books out of it, and piled them up beside him. The stacks grew into trees, towers, magic mountains. He looked at the last book in his hand. When the clock struck 13, a tale of time travel. If he'd believed in omens, this would have been a sign. He banged the bottom of the shelves with his fists to loosen them from their fastenings. Then he stepped back. There, layer by layer, it appeared. Behind the wall of words. The door to the room where... I could simply buy a table. Monsieur Perdu ran his hand over his mouth. Yes. Dust down the books. Put them away again. Forget about the door. Buy a table and carry on as he had for the last 2 decades. In 20 years' time, he'd be 70. And from there he'd make it through the rest. Maybe he'd die prematurely. Coward. He tightened his trembling fist on the door handle. Slowly, the tall man opened the door. He pushed it softly inward, screwed up his eyes, and... nothing but moonlight and dry air. He breathed it in through his nose, analyzing it, but found nothing. Smell has gone.
That was a sampling of The Little Paris Bookshop by Nina George. During her 12 years as a Virgin Atlantic flight attendant, Mandy Smith experienced the good, the bad, and the naughty. She candidly serves up the story of her life as a trolley dolly in Cabin Fever, the sizzling secrets of a virgin flight attendant. Welcome, Mandy, and thanks for stopping by the Book Report.
Oh, you're welcome. It's lovely to meet you.
What made you try out to be a virgin flight attendant?
I was actually working in engineering at the time, and I'd been there for 3 years and got quite bored working in an office environment. So one of the engineers said to me, why don't you try to go and be an air hostess, as his wife was an air hostess for British Airways. And he said, I'm sure you'll love it. It's, you know, it would suit your personality and you'd have lots of fun. And while you're young, you should travel a bit more. And I just thought, yeah, I'm going to go for it. So I did.
When did you first meet Richard Branson and what was he like?
I guess I first met him when I worked in engineering on the ground, because he used to be in the meetings and he would always be at the bar. There was a bar in the head office and headquarters, so he was, you know, quite generous. He'd be buying drinks for everyone after work and stuff, because the bar opened up at 5:30 when the office is closed. I met him then and he was always very generous.
What year was that?
Probably 96, 97. Started.
All right. Tell us about Galley FM. I loved reading about it.
Oh, Galley FM is just our little, it's like a little gossip. We can hear about different people and different things. And sometimes I've even been known to set off my own little rumors just to see how quickly they'll come back to me.
You traveled everywhere. What were your top 3 destinations and why?
Oh, definitely Cape Town and San Francisco and, probably say the Caribbean, St. Lucia. And Cape Town is just one of those places that has everything that you could possibly need there. I mean, the rand, which is their currency, was so good with the dollar, you know, the exchange rate. You'd get so much for your money that the shopping was fantastic. There are lots of mountainous regions, so you can go hiking, or, you know, there's Table Mountain, which just watch the sunset over there. There's beaches, there's Stellenbosch, which is their vineyard area. Mm-hmm. And, it was just one beautiful place, and the food is spectacular. But it's very similar to San Francisco in a way, because, again, they've got the whole vineyard area, which and the shopping's fantastic. And, you know, just that whole Castro's area down in San Francisco is amazing.
Have things changed since flight attendants continued to work in their 40s and 50s and... How has the industry changed?
I guess it's changed in respect to people with a little bit more responsibility and experience within their job and their role, which is good, I think. You know, it's always good to have a high turnover of young staff to keep the company energetic and vibrant and at the forefront of innovation. But when it comes to experience, you can't really buy that. And in situations where cabin crew might be needed, that's invaluable.
You write so poignantly about 9/11 and its aftermath. What was your experience during those very dark days?
Oh, it was very, very strange for me to think that I'd personally affected whether somebody would live or die from going to work that day. Because I don't know if I wrote it in the book or not, actually, but the girl that I swapped the trip with, I can't remember what I've called her in the book, but she's a good friend of mine. Obviously, I don't want to say her real name. But she was seeing one of the bankers that worked in the towers, and he took the day off to visit with her because I'd swapped the trip with her. So she then went to New York and he had the day off, and had she not gone to New York to see him, he would have been at work that day.
Oh.
So he's, you know, very strange that to feel that, oh, that just gives me shivers now thinking about it. You know, if we hadn't have swapped trips, then he might not be around today, bless him.
We're speaking with Mandy Smith on The Book Report.
Are there armed marshals now on most international flights?
I think on certain flights there are, and you know, we don't get to know who they are as cabin crew, because we don't. If we knew who they were, we'd probably give them special treatment, you know.
Mm-hmm.
As you do, we all look after each other, so we're not told who they are anymore. So, you know, so we don't get to pick them out from the crowd. They just kind of blend in with the passengers, but. Yeah, certain airlines have them on every single flight.
Wow. Okay, were there any celebrity passengers you remember fondly, and can you share some stories?
Oh, lots of celebrity stories that I remember fondly, because they were, you know, most celebs are lovely, and it's just lovely to meet them and, you know, find out that people you've been watching the telly are just normal people. They're not, you know, they're not this unattainable, nasty person or whatever you thought they were. They're lovely people. And I think one person that really is exactly as I'd imagine him to be would be Patrick Swayze.
Hmm.
Such a gentleman, such a nice, adorable person. You know, he was so sweet. And he was really sweet because he was on the phone, because we got the phones in upper class that you can call the ground on. So he was on the phone to one of his friends, and they were saying, I'm actually on the plane right now. I'm talking to you on the plane. And he was just so sweet and adorable that he was quite a person. It's lovely.
Okay, so here's a tough question. Would you like your daughter to become a flight attendant?
Do you know, I've been asked this before, and as obviously I'm a parent now, so that scares the living daylights out of me that my daughter will get my itchy feet and, you know, my urge to travel, because my whole family have done this. You know, my auntie did the same thing. She went off traveling on her own when she was 16, and I've been off traveling on my own around the world, you know, just on standby by myself, as well as working for Virgin. So she probably will get that itchy feet when she's a lot older, and I'd love her to do this, because it's one of those jobs that you can allow them to go and travel the world, and you know that she's not going to be in danger, she's not going to get mugged. You know, like when you're traveling on your own, and the girls take a year out, usually after university now or college, and you know, they do these year outs, and you don't know where they are and whether they're being looked after. But if they're flight attendants, you know, they're staying at 5-star hotels, they've got people to pick up their luggage for them. You know, it's a good way for your children to travel the world, I think, as a parent looking at it from that perspective.
Any final thoughts about cabin fever?
I guess it's just, I just like to say that it's one of those books that's based on my experience and my stories, and I've written it in a memoir, but it's as a chick lit style, so it's quite a fast and fun read. So it's not meant to be a serious book, it's not meant to offend anyone, but it's out there, and it's just going to be fun to read and take on holiday with you for the beach.
Well, I can affirm that it was so much fun. I actually read it on an airplane in one trip. Mandy, thank you so much for joining us today. The book was really fun. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
All right. Bye.
Meg Wolitzer can always be counted on for thought-provoking storylines. The Position, her newest, is the tale of one extraordinary family at the height of the sexual revolution, and it follows them through the 30-year hangover that followed. In 1975, Paul and Roz Mello wrote a best-selling Joy of Sex-type book that mortified their four school-aged children and changed the family forever.
30 years later, as the now dispersed family members argue over whether to reissue the book, we see the complicated lives of each of the grown children and their conflict and their conflicts in love, work, marriage, parenting, and sex. Shea Sands performs the book.
The Mellows' family life was also defined by a song, which had often been sung on vacations. For years, as they barreled along expressways toward colonial Williamsburg with its candle dippers and loom sitters, or else toward a sleepy, shabby resort in the Poconos called the Roaring Fire Lodge, with everyone and their stuff packed tight into the Volvo station wagon, they would sing it. "Oh, we're the Mellows," they sang. "Some girls and some fellows." And then they would continue in such a vein, using names of other families from the neighborhood. "We're not the Gambles, 'cause we'd be covered with brambles." Or, "We're not the Dryers, 'cause we'd be liars." Or, "We're not the Rinslers, 'cause we'd be..." A stumped silence descended upon the car while everyone tried to think their way out of this one. "Tinslers!" shrieked Claudia, the youngest, and though this made no sense, the whole family paused for a moment, the older children making derisive groans that were quickly evil-eyed by the parents, and then they all gave in and sang Claudia's rhyme. Every family in the world had its own corny, pointless song, or a set of ignored books, or a wall calendar, or a rolling battery drawer, all of which resembled, but only in part, those of other families. These details had been introduced into the Mellow household long ago, and they were there for good. Here in the den, Michael Mellow leaped onto the couch barefoot, summoned silently, and there, second shelf from the top, he found it. The book was white-spined, hard-backed, thick, sizzling, with a colophon of a mermaid gracing the spine, hand on hip, bifurcated tail flipped up in insouciance. It was the mermaid herself who seemed to be speaking to him. What she said was this: "Pick it up, Michael. Go on, don't be afraid. You have nothing to fear but fear itself." This last line was one that he had learned in social studies that very week. Pulling hard, he yanked the book from its vacuum, glanced at his spoils briefly in terror, and then tucked it under his shirt, feeling its glossy surface against his bare, matte skin. Forgetting the mini-stapler forever. Forgetting the step-by-step progression of egg osmosis. Then he clambered up two flights of stairs and disappeared into the murk of his bedroom for one solid hour. What he saw in the book was something that Michael Mellow began to realize during that hour he could not tolerate alone. He would have to bring Holly in on it, for he often brought her in when something was simply too difficult or perplexing or exciting or opaque to process on his own. She was older. She knew things. She had a worldly, cynical perspective that he lacked. But then he thought, no, it can't be just Holly, for she would think it was strange, even perverse, for her brother to invite her to sit with him and look at this thing. So he would have to invite the two others to look at it too, and it could become an important moment of sibling closeness and eternal bond. That was what he would do. For if your parents write a book like this, one that's just burst out into the world, there's no way you can read it on your own and not discuss it, just as there's no way you can snub it entirely, act cool and indifferent in its presence. There's no way you can exist in the same house with that book, walking by it in the den while it's up there burning on the shelf, and tell yourself, "I'm not ready for this." Michael sat on the bed in his room, book open on his lap. Sweat had formed in the notch above his upper lip, and he licked it quickly away, but already this innocent gesture seemed somehow sexual. And so did the taste of human broth in which bodies were basted. His own sweat had taken on a new quality, and so had his tongue, which seemed thick and alive. What would be next, his thumb pad? The knob of his knee? Was everything that belonged to the body up for grabs and reinterpretation? A little while later, he returned the book to its proper place and said nothing to anyone. But already he had set his plan in motion, and now he waited. The following day, early in the afternoon, Michael said to the others, "They're gone. I heard the car." It was a wet Saturday, and they were all corralled inside the house. The whole suburb of Wantaka seemed to be in an early hibernation, with children from other families trapped and stunned in their own homes, Everyone inexplicably made helpless in the face of rain or a falling thermometer.
We have just heard The Position by Meg Wolitzer. Holly Madison takes us inside the legendary Playboy Mansion and offers a true-to-life introduction to the man who holds the key. A spontaneous decision at age 21 transformed small-town Oregon girl Holly Sue Cullen into Holly Madison, Hugh Hefner's number one girlfriend. But like Alice's journey into Wonderland, after Holly plunged down the rabbit hole, her life quickly devolved into an oppressive routine of strict rules, manipulation, and battles with ambitious, backstabbing bunnies. Life inside the mansion was no dream at all. In Down the Rabbit Hole, this thoughtful and introspective woman opens up about life inside the mansion, the drugs, the sex, the abuse, the infamous parties, and her real behind-the-scenes life with Bridget, Kendra, and of course, Mr. Playboy himself. The book, performed by the author, is a cautionary tale and a celebration of personal empowerment. It spotlights the importance of fighting for our dreams and finding the life we deserve.
"Don't you miss the mansion?" squealed a round-faced, wholesome-looking 20-something girl in a high-pitched voice. I started, unsure of how to answer her politely. "No," I said, offering her a half-hearted smile. Here I was, an independent, successful woman, making millions of dollars a year all on my own, headlining a hit show on the Las Vegas Strip, co-producing and starring in my own television show, and this woman was asking me if I missed the mansion? Clearly, the public perception of the life I shared with Hugh Hefner at the Playboy Mansion was a far, far cry from the actual reality I experienced. That question wasn't really that uncommon. Fans would regularly ask me about my time living what they assumed was this lavish, decadent life in Holmby Hills, and whether or not I regretted my decision to leave. "Hef really f***ed up when he let you go," a young fan said, shaking her head at a Las Vegas meet and greet. That was another one I was regularly on the receiving end of. "It's okay," I would always say. "I'm much better off now." I couldn't, and still can't, believe that these adult women were actually serious. While filming the e-reality series The Girls Next Door, I never thought of myself or my two co-stars as role models or anyone to be taken seriously. I thought people were just laughing at us. I thought of us as walking advertisements. "Don't try this at home, kids." I'm not stupid. I know how unsavory the whole situation was. You could read it all over my unsmiling face. Cameras often caught me rolling my eyes or looking totally disinterested. As if I didn't feel trapped enough, I built up a wall around me. I'd gotten myself into a bad situation, but I became distinctly aware that was not the impression fans walked away with. The show was the epitome of mindless reality television, which was fine. We all have our guilty pleasures that we like to unwind to at the end of the day. There is something underneath the surface that isn't okay about it, though. Around the turn of the millennium, it became fashionable for women to appear stupid, to get by solely on their looks, and to be only concerned with fame and materialism. Some of the effects of that moment in the zeitgeist still linger today. And somewhere along the way, I too bought into the ludicrous fantasy, perhaps even more so than others. While there was a part of me that acknowledged the idiocy and superficiality that surrounded me, I fell for the glamour, hook, line, and sinker. It took years for me to realize just how manipulated and used I'd been. I could never admit that to myself at the time, because to do so would have been to acknowledge how dark and scary a situation I was in, and how very little in control I was. I'm an adult. I'm here because I choose to be. I'm here for adventure, a once-in-a-lifetime experience. I'm here as a stepping stone to something else, I routinely told myself. And perhaps the biggest disillusion, I'm here for love. Deeper and deeper, I fell down the rabbit hole. Many people may think that I'm biting the hand that fed me and that I should be grateful for the opportunity Girls Next Door and Playboy afforded me. And while I am grateful, it's also clear to me that most people fail to realize that there are two sides to every coin and that even the most fantastic fairy tale has a dark underbelly. Being attached to Playboy can make people not want to have anything to do with you, even in quirky, crazy Hollywood. There were many times the hateful backlash made me wish I stayed the broke, awkward, 21-year-old waitress I'd been before Hef came into my life. When I finally did find the strength to leave the mansion, I began receiving lucrative offers to reveal my version of events, but I never pursued them. I wasn't interested in writing a sensational tell-all for the sole purpose of exposing someone else's strange habits and dirty secrets. Don't worry, you'll find those things here, but in the context of something bigger. I wanted to have my own story to tell, too. To this day, it astounds me the number of misconceptions that abound about my life and my experiences while at the mansion. Usually, the version of the story most flattering to Hef is the one that prevails.
That was Down the Rabbit Hole by Holly Madison. Bridget Jones fans, meet Lily Wilder, New York lawyer and bride-to-be, and the subject of Eliza Kennedy's delightful I Take You. Lily's got a dream job, great friends, and a family full of charismatic and loving women, and a total catch of a fiancé. But this gal has no business getting married. Lily's fiancé, Will, is a brilliant, handsome archaeologist. Lily is sassy, impulsive, fond of a good drink, or two, or three, and completely incapable of being faithful to just one man. Lily likes Will, but does she love him? Will loves Lily, but does he know her? As the wedding approaches, Lily's days and nights of booze, laughter, and questionable decisions become a growing reminder that the happiest day of her life might turn out to be her worst mistake yet. Julia Whelan narrates.
I've never shown up to work in this condition before, so everything is strange and new and a little hilarious. I start to laugh, which gets me some dark looks. Then I hit an unexpected pocket of turbulence in the hallway. Oh no, I'm going down. Fortunately, a wall saves me. You know what? Thank God for walls. Whoever put them in this hallway had a lot of foresight. Whoever invented them was a freaking... I slip inside a bathroom and splash water on my face. That's better. I head for my office. The light is on in Lyle's room, so I stop by. There he is, surrounded by piles of paper and greasy takeout containers, banging away at his laptop, looking all sweaty, pale, and infarcted. Lyle and I work on the same litigation team for the same partner. I'm in my second year at the firm, he's in his fifth. You could say we're friendly rivals, kindred spirits, just super, super close. Go f*** yourself, he says. I drop into a chair. What's up, Mighty Mouse? He sighs heavily. How many times have I asked you not to call me that? 11. What's going on around here? It's after midnight. The plaintiffs in the Lucas case filed a motion for a preliminary injunction. He's still typing furiously. We have 48 hours to respond. Can you help? I flick at a piece of sparkly club confetti stuck to my dress. Afraid not. Lyle reads through what he's typed, hits return, hits it harder, shouts, God, at the screen, hits return really hard, exhales, cracks his neck, and turns to me. She cannot help. He's doing his annoying third-person zombie monotone thing. Why is she here? Pesky confetti. I flick at it again. Because Philip texted her. Lyle frowns. He's here. Apparently we won. Philip doesn't know how to text. I shrug. Maybe his secretary taught him. Bet he's 90. Why did he text you? Lyle is troubled. Lyle wonders why the partner did not text him. Lyle fears he is out of the loop. He picks up a pen and grips it tightly. There is so much love in your eyes right now, Lyle. I hold a hand to my heart. I can hardly stand it. For a second, I think he's going to lunge across the desk and stab me in the eye, but he manages to rein it in. Out, he says, pointing at the door with the pen. Now. I walk up 2 flights to the 45th floor, where the partners have their offices. The lighting is dim and expensive, the carpeting plush. Even the air smells better up here, crisp and fresh, like it was just imported from the Alps, which, who knows? I stroll the hallway, admiring the expensive art and framed artifacts from the firm's glorious past. Sepia-tinted photographs of the founding partners. Thank you notes from robber barons and titans of industry. A letter from Theodore Roosevelt bitching about his bill. Philip is reading a brief, feet up on his desk. I pause in the doorway. I oh so casually lean against the doorframe. I kind of miss. So I knock and say, "Yes, master?" He glances at me over his reading glasses.
"Wilder, come in."
He's wearing a tuxedo.
"I just came from a charity function,"
he explains. "Whoa," I hold up my hands. "Hey, a charity function, let's not get so specific, okay?" He regards me silently for a moment, then returns to his reading. I perch on the edge of one of his wing chairs and wait. It's a nice tuxedo.
That was I Take You by Eliza Kennedy. My Grandmother Asked Me to Tell You She's Sorry from Frederick Bachman is a warm-hearted novel receiving rave reviews. Elsa is 7 years old and different. Her grandmother is 77 years old and crazy. She's also Elsa's best and only friend. At night, Elsa takes refuge in her grandmother's stories, where everybody is different and nobody needs to be normal. When Elsa's grandmother dies and leaves behind a series of letters apologizing to people she's wronged, Elsa's greatest adventure begins. Her grandmother's letters lead her to an apartment building full of drunks, monsters, attack dogs, and totally ordinary old crones, but also to the truth about fairy tales and kingdoms, and a grandmother like no other. Joan Walker narrates.
Britt Marie lives one floor down from Granny. And really, Britt Marie also lives one floor down from Elsa's mum, because Elsa's mum lives next door to Elsa's granny. And Elsa obviously also lives next door to Granny because Elsa lives with her mum. Except every other weekend when she lives with Dad and Lisette. And of course, George is also Granny's neighbour because he lives with Mum. It's a bit all over the place. But anyway, to get back to the point, life-saving and driving people nuts are Granny's superpowers, which perhaps makes her a bit of a dysfunctional superhero. Elsa knows this because she looked up dysfunctional on Wikipedia. People of Granny's age describe Wikipedia as an encyclopedia but on the net. Encyclopedias are what Elsa describes as Wikipedia but analog. Elsa has checked dysfunctional in both places, and it means that something is not functioning quite as it's supposed to, which is one of Elsa's favourite things about her granny. But maybe not today, because it's 1:30 in the morning and Elsa is fairly tired and would really like to go back to bed. Except that's not going to happen because Granny's been throwing turds at a policeman. It's a little complicated. Elsa looks around the little rectangular room and yawns listlessly and so widely that she looks like she's trying to swallow her own head. "I did tell you not to climb the fence," she mutters, checking her watch. Granny doesn't answer. Elsa takes off her Gryffindor scarf and puts it in her lap. She was born on Boxing Day 7 years ago, almost 8. The same day some German scientists recorded the strongest ever emission of gamma radiation from a magnetar over the Earth. Admittedly, Elsa doesn't know what a magnetar is, but it's some kind of neutron star, and it sounds a little like Megatron, which is the name of the evil one in Transformers, which is what simpletons who don't read enough quality literature call a children's program. In actual fact, the Transformers are robots, but if you look at it academically, they could also be counted as superheroes. Elsa is very keen on both Transformers and neutron stars, and she imagines that an emission of gamma radiation would look a bit like that time Granny spilled Fanta on Elsa's iPhone and tried to dry it out in the toaster. And Granny says it makes Elsa special to have been born on a day like that. and being special is the best way of being different. Granny is busy distributing small heaps of tobacco all over the wooden table in front of her and rolling them into rustling cigarette papers. I said, I told you not to climb the fence. Granny makes a snorting sound and searches the pockets of her much too large overcoat for a lighter. She doesn't seem to be taking any of this very seriously, mainly because she never seems to take anything seriously, except when she wants to smoke and can't find a lighter. It was a tiny little fence, for God's sake, she says breezily. It's nothing to get worked up about. Don't you, for God's sake, me. You're the one who threw shit at the police. Stop fussing. You sound like your mother. Do you have a lighter? I'm 7. How long are you going to use that as an excuse? Until I'm not 7 anymore? Granny mumbles something that sounds like, not a crime to ask, is it? And continues riffling through her pockets. I don't think you can smoke in here, actually, Elsa informs her, sounding calmer now and fingering the long rip in the Gryffindor scarf. Course you can smoke, we'll just open a window. Elsa looks sceptically at the windows. I don't think they're the sort of windows that open. Why not? They've got bars on them. Granny glares with dissatisfaction at the windows, and then at Elsa. So now you can't even smoke at the police station. Jesus, it's like being in 1984. Elsa yawns again. Can I borrow your phone? What for? To check something. Where? Online. You invest too much time on that internet stuff.
That was My Grandmother Asked Me to Tell You She's Sorry by Frederick Bachman. Crazy Rich Asians is the funny, much-talked-about debut novel from Kevin Kwan about three super-rich, pedigreed Chinese families and the gossip, backbiting, and scheming that occurs when the heir to one of the most massive fortunes in Asia brings home his ABC, American-born Chinese, girlfriend, to the wedding of the season. When Rachel Chu agrees to spend the summer in Singapore with her boyfriend Nicholas Young, she envisions a humble family home, long drives to explore the island, and quality time with the man she might one day marry. What she doesn't know is that Nick's family home happens to look like a palace, that she'll ride in more private planes than cars, and that with one of Asia's most eligible bachelors on her arm, Rachel might as well have a target on her back. Initiated into a world of dynastic splendor beyond imagination, Rachel meets Astrid, the it girl of Singapore. Eddie, whose family lives in the pages of the Hong Kong socialite magazines, and Eleanor, Nick's formidable mother, a woman with strong feelings about who her son should and should not marry. Crazy Rich Asians is an insider's look at the Asian jet set, the clash between old and new money, between overseas and mainland Chinese, and about what it means to be young, in love, and crazy rich. Lin Chen performs the book.
Nick laughed, slathering jam and clotted cream onto a scone still warm from the oven. And doesn't a good friend of yours live in Singapore? Yes, Pek Lin, my best friend from college, Rachel said. She's been trying to get me to come visit for years. All the more reason. Rachel, you're going to love it. And I just know you're going to flip out over the food. You do realize Singapore is the most food-obsessed country on the planet. Well, just watching the way you fawn over everything you eat, I figured it's pretty much the national sport. Remember Calvin Trillin's New Yorker piece on Singapore street foods? I'll take you to all the local dives even he doesn't know about. Nick took another bite of his fluffy scone and continued with his mouth full. I know how much you love these scones. Just wait till you taste my ama's. Your ama bakes scones? Rachel tried to imagine a traditional Chinese grandmother preparing this quintessentially English confection. Well, she doesn't exactly bake them herself, but she has the best scones in the world, you'll see.
Nick said, turning around reflexively to make sure no one in the cozy little spot had overheard him. He didn't want to become persona non grata at his favorite cafe for carelessly pledging allegiance to another scone, even if it was his grandmother's. At a neighboring table, the girl huddled behind a three-tiered stand piled high with finger sandwiches was getting increasingly excited by the conversation she was overhearing. She suspected it might be him, but now she had absolute confirmation. It was Nicholas Young. Even though she was only 15 at the time, Celine Lim never forgot the day she first laid eyes on him. It was at Palau Club, Singapore's most prestigious private country club, where membership was practically harder to obtain than a knighthood. They were having lunch at the poolside cafe when Nicholas strolled past their table and flashed that devastating grin of his at her sister Charlotte. "Is that one of the Leung brothers?" their mother had asked. "No, that's Nicholas Young, a cousin of the Leungs," Charlotte replied. "Philip Young's boy? Yeah, when did he shoot up like that? He's so handsome now," Mrs. Lim exclaimed. "He's just back from Oxford, double majored in history and law," Charlotte added, anticipating her mother's next question. "Why didn't you get up and talk to him?" Mrs. Lim said excitedly. "Why should I bother when you swat away every guy who dares come near?" Charlotte answered curtly. "Alla, Mac, stupid girl, I am only trying to protect you from fortune hunters. This one you'd be lucky to have. This one you can shong." Celine couldn't believe her mother was actually encouraging her big sister to snatch this boy. She stared curiously at Nicholas, now laughing animatedly with his friends at a table under a blue and white umbrella by the pool. Even from afar, he stood out in high relief. Unlike the other fellows with their regulation Indian barbershop haircuts, Nicholas had perfectly tousled black hair, chiseled Cantonese pop idol features, and impossibly thick eyelashes. He was the cutest, dreamiest guy she'd ever seen.
"Charlotte, why don't you go over and invite him to your fundraiser on Saturday?" their mother kept on.
"Stop it, Mum," Charlotte smiled through gritted teeth. "I know what I'm doing." As it turned out, Charlotte did not know what she was doing, since Nicholas never showed up at her fundraiser, much to their mother's eternal disappointment. But that afternoon at Palau Club left such an indelible mark on Celine's adolescent memory that 6 years later, and on the other side of the planet, she still recognized him.
"Hannah, let me get a picture of you with that delicious sticky toffee pudding," Celine said, taking out her camera phone.
She pointed it in the direction of her friend, but surreptitiously trained the lens on Nicholas.
We have just heard Crazy Rich Asians by Kevin Kwan. Paula McLean, author of The Paris Wife, transports us to colonial Kenya in the 1920s. Circling the Sun profiles a fearless, captivating woman, Beryl Markham, a record-setting aviator caught in a passionate love triangle with safari hunter Dennis Finch-Hatton and Karen Blixen, author of Out of Africa. Brought to Kenya from England as a child and then abandoned by her mother, Beryl is raised by both her father and the Africans who work his estate. Her unconventional upbringing transforms Beryl into a bold woman with a fierce love of all things wild and an inherent understanding of nature's delicate balance. Beryl forges her own path as a horse trainer. Her uncommon style attracts the eye of the Happy Valley set, a decadent bohemian community of European expats who live and love by their own rules. But it's the ruggedly charismatic Dennis Finch-Hatton who ultimately helps Beryl navigate the uncharted territory of her own heart. The intensity of their love reveals Beryl's truest self and her fate, to fly. McLean's powerful tale, performed by Catherine McEwen, reveals the extraordinary adventures of a woman before her time, the exhilaration of freedom and its cost.
I steady my position and lean into my stick, roaring past the onlookers with their cameras, and then the series of markers towards the single red flag that means the point of no return. I have a mile of runway and not an inch more. And she might not make it, of course. After all the planning and care and work and mustering of courage, there is the overwhelming possibility that the gull will stay fixed to the earth, more elephant than butterfly, and that I'll fail before I've even begun. But not before I give this moment everything I've got. After 500 feet of runway, her tail comes up, ponderously. I urge her faster, feeling the drag of gravity, the impossible weight of her, feeling more than seeing the red flag growing nearer. Then the rudder and elevator finally come to life, swinging her nose up, and she's left the earth, arrow straight. A butterfly after all. We climb the dimming sky and the rain over green and grey checkered Swindon. Ahead lies the Irish Sea, all that dark, dark water ready to grip and stop my heart. The smeary twinkling that is Cork. The hulking black of Labrador. The constant sobbing of the engine, doing the work it was built for. My nose bouncing, I drive hard through the wet spatter, thrusting into the climb and the shudder of pressing weather. The instincts for flying are in my hands, and the practical work of it too. And then there is the more mysterious and essential thing. How I'm meant to do this, and always have been, to stitch my name on the sky with this propeller, these lacquered linen wings. 36 hours in the dark. It was 2 years ago when the challenge first came up, in the noisy cedar-panelled bar of the White Rhino in Nyeri. There were tornadoes of pepper-flecked beef on my plate, blanched asparagus spears, each as narrow as my smallest finger, and deep-stained claret in all our glasses. Then a dare thrown out, like a last course, from J.C. Carberry. No one has managed the Atlantic solo from this side, England to America. Not man or woman. What do you say, Beryl? 2 years earlier, Mollison had fallen short in a similar water jump, and no one had done much more than imagine the aeroplane that could accomplish the distance. But JC had more money than he could ever spend, and the spark of a Magellan or a Peary. And there it was, the boundless ocean, thousands of miles of icy virgin air, a clear frontier, and no plane. Want to chance it? JC's eyes were like agates. I watched them glitter and thought of how his beautiful wife, Maya, should be there in white silk with perfectly marcelled hair. But she had died years ago in a simple flying lesson near Nairobi on a day with no wind or weather. She was the first air tragedy that hit close to us, but not the last. Many other dear ghosts were glinting from the past, winks of light playing along the rims of our wine glasses, reminding us of how reckless they'd been and how magnificent. I didn't really need reminding. I hadn't forgotten those ghosts for a moment. And somehow, when I met JC's gaze, I felt ready to pull them even closer. Yes, I said, and then said it again. It's not long at all before the last bits of light rinse from the ragged edge of the sky, and then there's only the rain and the smell of petrol. I'm flying at 2,000 feet above sea level, and will be for nearly 2 days. Dense clouds have swallowed the moon and stars. The dark so complete, I have no choice but to fly on instruments, blinking away fatigue, to peer at the dimly lit dials. I have no wireless, so the sound and force of my engine and the wind blowing back against my nose at 40 knots are soothing.
We have just heard Circling the Sun by Paula MacLean. Readers, while I was in school, I always looked forward to summer and the freedom to choose whatever I wanted to read. School days are, of course, long ago, but there's still something special about summer reading. I hope we've previewed some titles you'll want to pack along on your summer wanderings. Check my website, bookreportradio.com, for worlds of choices. Thanks so much for journeying with me today. Let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.